What's up, you beautiful people? Welcome back to Crime Ghoul, a true crime podcast where I'm your host, Brittany. Here I talk to you about all things true crime while I'm accompanied by my super cute, furry, bat piggy co-host, Kylo. He's a French bulldog, Boston Terrier, and he makes all of this morbid, dark material super bearable for me and definitely enjoys watching true crime documentaries just as much as I do. So if you're new here, welcome. If you're a returning listener, thank you so much. I love you guys. I hope you're ready to get into a new case today. I like to, you know, go through cases that aren't as heavily covered in the media. Of course, sometimes I delve into those popular cases because, I mean, how could you not? They're just fun to dissect and learn about and stuff like that. So today's episode is definitely a case that I haven't heard too much about. So I'm super excited to bring it to you guys. Maybe you have heard of it, maybe you haven't. Definitely let me know, but let's jump right into it. You know the drill, go brew yourself a cup of coffee, pour yourself a glass of wine, perhaps take a shot of whiskey because of course, as always, these cases are not for the faint of heart. Thank you so much for listening. Today's case takes place in New Britain, Connecticut. Now imagine you're a hunter or hiker. You're hiking through the woods with your dog and you're trying to find a spot to hunt. Up ahead, you notice a clearing. You step on a branch, it cracks. You hear all of the birds around you. You smell the fresh air. And then you notice something. Something that doesn't quite look right. Something is sticking out of the earth and it looks like bone. Maybe a skull? Has to be an animal skull. But if that's the case, why does it look so human? You get closer and you're certain it is human. It's definitely human remains. You skedaddle out of there and you call 911. That is where our story starts today. Once law enforcement arrived on the scene, they would find what seemed to be a dumping ground. They began to uncover several body parts, and soon they would discover that the mutilated remains had belonged to three different women. They would later be identified as 53-year-old Diane Kuzak, 23-year-old Javelin Martinez, and 40-year-old Mary Jane Menard. Years prior to the discovery of their bodies, these women all went missing within the same six-month time frame. And this is their story. This whole story takes place between 2003 and 2007. Melanie Camilleni fell into an opioid addiction. She had children who stayed with her little sister, Jessica. Melanie would disappear for months at a time, but no matter what, she stayed in touch with her kids. A year had gone by and Melanie had not checked in with her children or her family. Jessica worried because no matter how much trouble Melanie ever found herself in, she always contacted her family. Melanie was known to be bold, strong, and funny. Unfortunately, she fell into the wrong crowd during her teen years, and they introduced her to drugs. At this time, Melanie changed drastically. She was getting into a lot of trouble, and she became super combative. As it turns out, Melanie would be the first victim. The monster in this true story is William Howell. He recalls the day he decided to rape his first prostitute. He claimed he went to a hardware store and he was feeling exhilarated and nervous. He bought tools that day because at this point, he decided he would have to murder the prostitute to cover up what he planned to do. And he would say that this was his ultimate fantasy. That day, he picked up Melanie Camilleni and he took her to a secluded location where he began to rape her, tied her up to a bench in the back of his van, and then repeated the same horrific atrocity over and over again. He would claim he had a cool down period and would fall asleep, wake up, and commit the same thing over and over again. By the morning, he said that he knew he had to kill Melanie because of what he had done to her for hours on end. He knew that she would go and report him to the police. He was stunned when she was unfazed by a brutal attack he had committed against her. He took a hammer and hit her in the temple of her head, hoping to knock her out, and while she was unconscious, he would kill her. Melanie fought for her life, and she said, "Please, I have children, don't kill me." And at first, he considered letting her go, but then said he had to go through with it. He had to do it, and he knew it had to be done quick. So he decided to strangle her and killed her. At this point, William knew he crossed the line and had nothing left to lose going forward. So that's really what made him continue in these atrocities moving forward. Because he knew if he was caught, the consequences would just be the same. So why not just continue on? He decided to bury Melanie in the woods behind a strip mall. There was an embankment he would walk down, then he would come to this clearing, walk into some brush, and then to a ravine. It was here that he decided he would bury his victims. But it was February, so the ground was frozen, and he had difficulties digging. So William decided to keep Melanie in his van. She was in his van wrapped up for 2 weeks, and he viciously dismantled her jaw and sliced off her fingertips in an attempt to remove Melanie's identity. After 2 weeks had passed, he found a plastic barrel and placed Melanie in the barrel and left her at the bottom of the woods near the ravine. Then he would flee to Virginia for several months. He would return to New Britain, Connecticut when springtime arrived, and he immediately went back to the woods where he left Melanie and finally buried her. He would end up continuing this practice with the rest of his victims. Whenever he had to dispose of a victim, he would return to the woods behind the very busy strip mall. It's so creepy to think about the fact that this mall was busy with people, flooded with people. Meanwhile, in the back, he was going into the woods dumping bodies. But nobody would ever have known. It was just a gross area of woods that nobody would really ever go down. So it really worked out for him. William would end up storing a shovel inside of a guardrail, and he frequented his favorite spot where he would then make his way through the garbage-littered woods. He'd go down a hill to the ravine, like I said, and he would begin to dig very shallow graves and bury the women beneath the earth. He called this his garden. Ugh. Nasty. He's nasty. Mary Jane Menard's daughter, Tiffany, describes her mother as the rock of the family. Tiffany was only 18 years old when her mom disappeared. She said she left her mom's house, said goodbye, and never saw her alive again. Mary Jane was spotted getting into a black or blue van driven by a man named Bill. This information was brought to police, but the investigation never got further than that. It's pretty much a shame because, you know, had they investigated, they probably would have gotten on this guy's tail a lot quicker, but unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. Anne K. Howard was an attorney who lived in central Connecticut, and she had been researching local cold cases. Around 2007, one story kept popping up on her news feed, and it was an article that read that in New Britain, Connecticut, 3 bodies were found dumped behind a local strip mall. Anne immediately became invested in this story. She wanted to know who the killer was, and she started a blog about it. She kept researching cold cases nearby and unsolved murders. She wanted to know if there were more bodies than only 3. Anne would end up playing a very significant role in today's story, so keep her in mind. 33-year-old Nielsa Esmeretti was from a neighboring town. She lived in Westerfield, Connecticut, and went missing around the same time William's first 3 victims had disappeared. This was back in 2003. Nielsa was living in the Almar Motel with her boyfriend named Ace, and they were known for getting into disputes with one another, and they lived a more risky and dangerous lifestyle. They lived a life full of drugs and drinking. Nielsa was a sex worker, and that's how they got a majority of their money in drugs. Unlike the other women in this story, Nielsa's case had been solved before William's garden had been discovered. You see, there was a man that Nielsa and Ace knew, and he was a frequent customer. He also partied with them often. He was 5'9 and 250 pounds. This man was their drug dealer and a nearby gardener slash landscaper. This was William Devin Howell. He was known for traveling in his beat-up van, that he used for work, and he often brought sex workers into that van, which I don't even know how because the inside of this van was trashed. Disgusting. If you want a visual, head over to my page on Instagram, crimeghoul_, and you could take a look at it. And just looking at it, you could tell the van smelled like shit, but I digress. So this van was eventually linked to William Howell, and the van had blood on the middle back seat. William claimed that Nielsa and her boyfriend got into a fight in the back seat, and he had hit Nielsa, drawing blood. But police didn't believe this. The results came back as the DNA of Nielsa, and they also found DNA from another blood spatter that was in the van, but unfortunately, they were unable to make an immediate identification. So because of this, police had an idea that there could possibly be more victims. And at this point, Nielsa's body had not been found. So William was charged with the disappearance and the murder of Nielsa as Mirande. And William took a plea bargain and got 16 years for manslaughter because they didn't have a body. So it just worked out for him, unfortunately. And again, this was before the dumping ground was found. So William would say that he began soliciting prostitutes at just 14 years old. Okay, I think about a 14-year-old and I'm just like, Jesus, that is a baby. He would steal his dad's car and drive to a local red light district, and it became his favorite secret, I guess, until he had a secret garden anyway. At just 12 years old, William's mom died from cancer, and she had been his everything. She was a great mom, a good disciplinarian, just kept him on track, and when she passed away, he fell off the rails and began consuming a lot of alcohol to cope with the loss of his mother. So throughout high school, he claimed that he couldn't remember a day where he had not been drinking. He became addicted to alcohol and sex. By 30, he claimed that he had slept with 1,000 sex workers. At the time of William's killing spree, he had differentiated between what he called good girls and bad girls. At this time, he had a girlfriend named Dorothy Holcomb, which the van was actually registered in her name, not even his. And he labeled Dorothy as good and sex workers as bad. And William would later say that he had a lot of contempt and disdain towards sex workers because of their lifestyle. He believed that they were spreading disease and living risky lifestyles, which, to me, that's just stupid of him to say considering how much sex he had with prostitutes. He slept with 1,000 sex workers and hated them, but his favorite thing to do for a majority of his life was to solicit sex from them, so I don't really understand that. So I wonder how his view of these women had changed, because clearly from 14 years old, he was finding some type of enjoyment from being with sex workers, and he was finding some type of solace with them. And then all of a sudden for him to get older and then have such disdain and contempt, it's just kind of weird to me. So it wasn't until 2014 that the forensic labs were able to connect the Jane Does to missing women. Police spent a lot of time trying to link these victims, and out of nowhere, an inmate would come forward saying he had some information for detectives and that he would even be able to identify some of the victims by their first names. So this inmate began describing the victims that were found behind the strip mall. So what set off this confession? Well, the inmate named Jonathan Mills and William Howell were playing cards one day in prison. As one of the cards was turned over, a missing person's picture was on the back of the card, and it happened to be Joyvalyn Martinez. Police used this really, really smart tactic, and they would place missing persons on the back of these playing cards and then distributed them to prisoners. They were hoping that inmates might recognize missing people and give the information to the authorities. The cards were often used to solve cold cases, and they would put the info of these missing people on the back with a hotline to call. And a lot of inmates would take advantage of this so they could get their sentence reduced. So it was a really good tactic to use and would end up solving, you know, multiple cold cases. So it worked. So Howell revealed to Mills very intimate details that only the killer would have known. So he got a very cocky attitude while recounting the stories, and he was really proud of what he had done. Jonathan took this information and came forward to authorities with what he knew. Mills was actually able to draw a map of the shopping center and where the bodies could be located. This was beyond helpful for law enforcement. What he had drawn for officers was actually William's garden. William told Mills about driving around with Melanie for 2 weeks and that he called her baby. He called his van the Murdermobile and said he was the Sick Ripper and had a monster inside of him. After he told Mills all of this, he said he was going to bed and hoped to dream of his garden and the women under the soil. It's disgusting. Law enforcement acted quickly and they would end up unearthing 4 more bodies. So in total, there were 6 women and 1 man. They were able to identify 29-year-old Melanie Ruth Camellini, 44-year-old Danny Lee Wisneck, and 26-year-old Marilyn Mendez Gonzalez, and 33-year-old Nielsa Esmerende. Howell was charged with murder, capital felony murders, I should say, And investigators and attorneys would say that William came across as a nice person and actually an enjoyable person to talk to. So it was quite shocking to think that this man was the murderer. William decided that he didn't want a trial and he was prepared to plead guilty. Ann Howard, who I mentioned earlier, the attorney turned true crime writer, reached out to William and told him that she wanted to write a book about him. He ended up reaching back out to her and eventually told her everything. This is a little bit of what he told her. He told her about the McDonald's at the back of the strip mall. He explained that he would duct tape his victims' mouths and park in remote locations of parking lots and then rape them for 12 hours on again, off again. He mentioned that Nielsa wanted a ride. He offered her a ride and then raped her throughout the night and into the day and killed her and threw her down the hill. Sometimes he would drive the van up to the guardrail and slide open the van door, and he would take wrapped up body parts and would throw them over the steep embankment and return for them later. He spoke about Melanie and said he originally told her that he just wanted sex, but that wasn't true. He hit her with a hammer and then strangled her to death. He was living in his van and slept beside her body for 2 weeks and would call her corpse baby. Marilyn Gonzalez was a young mother and had a drug addiction. Howell picked her up and followed through with his horrific routine. He raped her throughout the night and got her McDonald's breakfast. Going to McDonald's for breakfast was actually a ritual he did quite often with others, and he would pull up to the drive-thru and told her not to make a sound or it would be her last. After killing Melanie and Marilyn, he went on a killing frenzy. Danny Wisnett went by Janice Roberts. She was transgender. He invited Janice into his van and he put his hands through Janice's hair and ended up pulling off a wig and soon realized that Janice was a man. He punched Janice twice and strangled her. He stated that he killed Janice to stop her from, quote unquote, duping others. Just horrible. William targeted society's most vulnerable people because he knew that nobody ever noticed that they were missing. And this is how William remained undetected. Diane Cusack was addicted to drugs and lived a difficult life on the streets. He went through his normal routine after picking her up, and he knew that she had no contact with her family, so he decided to add her to his garden. He definitely got off on going through the McDonald's drive-thru. He would blast music so no one would hear the girls screaming or crying, and he would ask the girls if they wanted anything to eat, and it just clearly shows how detached and incapable of empathy he was. Nielsa, however, was where he made a mistake. She refused to finish their drug transaction, and this enraged William. He wasn't planning to harm her at first, but ultimately chose to. Mary Jane Menard was in a difficult and dark place when he had come across her. She was clean from alcohol abuse, but she recently had a back surgery and unfortunately was prescribed opiate drugs for pain. This became expensive, thus she turned to heroin. She went to buy cigarettes and was never seen again. And then she was picked up by William. So Joyvaline Martinez was a track star in high school before she fell into drugs. She was 23 years old when she was picked up by William in Hartford, and he followed his normal routine. In 2007, the garden was unveiled. The secrets were unearthed. The hunter roaming the turnpike with his dog found the garden and called the police, and they immediately began an excavation of the location. So police started making links using the evidence and using DNA found from William's killing mobile. And ironically, on Melanie's birthday, police got in touch with her family to let them know that they had found her, and her family was devastated. These women were someone's beautiful sister, daughter, mothers, and so on, and he stole so much from these families. These families will forever have a gaping wound because you don't cope over something like this. How could you? How could you even process what happened to your loved one when it was so horrific? William says that he knows he's a monster, but says that his true character is not of a monster, which is really laughable in my opinion. He claims that he doesn't know why he became a killer and says that he was raised by a great family, a good home. He never killed animals growing up. So to him, he doesn't fit the mold that a normal serial killer would. So he doesn't understand why he is the way he is, other than for his own selfish reasons. He went on to state that he was binge drinking throughout half of the 90s and he was in jail for driving without a license and became angry and bitter during this time. Also during this time, he fantasized about raping women, but then decided to act on his impulses. At the time, he was pissed at his girlfriend and he got drunk and decided to act out his fantasy and murdered women to cover up the rapes he committed. He claimed that he chose to do it and that it wasn't that he couldn't control it. He chose to do what he did and chose not to care. So it seems like this guy is very self-aware, which is just haunting in itself. So today he claims that he feels remorse for the pain that he has brought his victims' loved ones. Not the pain he brought his victims, but their loved ones. So he said he would hear the family sobbing in the courtroom and that it really tore him apart. And he knew he was selfish for killing these people. Howell would go on to address his victims' families and would even apologize. But the loved ones, of course, they don't feel sympathy for him. I wouldn't either. I don't think you would either. He pled guilty because he didn't want to put the families or taxpayers through a trial, which, how kind of him. Personally, he says that he thinks he deserves the death penalty, and if he hadn't been caught, he said there probably would have been more victims, which is just terrifying. I wonder what would have happened had Nielsa not have been connected to William. Who knows? He probably would have continued killing people, never would have been linked to these murders, or maybe eventually he might have gone on to other states to commit these horrible atrocities as well. Who really knows? It's kind of creepy to think about. He remembers all of his victims, but he doesn't like discussing the people he has killed. He gets really flustered and shuts down, and he said the only one he would tell anything to was Anne, and now it's in a book. So if you want to know, he says to read the book. The book is titled His Garden, Conversations with the Serial Killer, written by Anne K. Howard. Anne says that there could be more victims out there. She wouldn't be surprised. And that police found several videotapes in William's van that depicted other women who have yet to be identified. So detectives want to know if they are victims, and if they are, who are they? So I'm going to post a bunch of pictures to today's case on my Instagram, crimeghoul_. Go take a look at those. But today, William Devin Howell is in an isolated cell in Connecticut, and he describes it as misery and wishes that he were dead. So, if you want my opinion, I think he has more than what he gave his victims, so he should be freaking happy he's alive, rotting in an isolated cell. I'm sure it is miserable, and when you're a killer, that's kind of what you get. Sorry, I'm not sorry. But I have never heard of William before, William Devin Howell, so I thought this was a very interesting case to explore, and it's really sad what he has done, what he did, and very disturbing at like how happy he was and like proud he was of having this garden. But then it's also quite strange to see how self-aware he was. Like, I feel like a lot of killers aren't super self-aware. They kind of describe it as impulses they couldn't control, but with him, he says he was very much aware of these impulses and could control them but chose not to, which is just even more horrifying to me, because somewhere in my mind I feel like if this is just like an impulse these monsters could not control, it's almost like not understandable, but I guess just not as scary as being able to have that understanding of what they're doing and how horrible it truly is. But that is the nature of William Devin Howell. So I guess what really screwed him was all of the drinking he did at a very young age, all of the sex he was having at a very young age. And I don't know if there's more that has happened. I mean, of course, losing his mother was clearly very traumatic to him, but I feel like usually traumatic events have to be coupled in there somewhere. So maybe something different than just his, you know, mother passing. Of course, it's traumatic, but somewhere there's got to be something, because, you know, serial killers usually have those unique recipes to becoming what they are. But if anybody knows of any other details, I didn't come across any, feel free to share. You can always go to Instagram for like the third or fourth time, crimeghoul_. That's how you'll find me. Or check out my Facebook, Twitter, just search Crime Ghoul. And yeah, come on over and let's talk about it. Let's have a little discussion about it. I love doing that. I love talking true crime. I love making new friends who like to talk about true crime. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I'm not sure which case I'm going to cover next week, but I'm definitely looking into it. I love when you guys give me case suggestions. Thank you so much. If you haven't heard your case yet, don't worry. I probably will cover it, but, you know, it might just be at a different timeline. Some of them I like to save for like October for around spooky season. You know, I have themes I like to follow. So if you haven't heard it yet, don't worry, you probably will. So keep those suggestions coming. If you don't want to reach out to me on social media, you could email me at crimeghoul5@gmail.com. If there's ever any cool true crime articles you want to send me, or, you know, just stuff to look at that has to do with true crime, or maybe it doesn't, send it my way. Love to hear from you guys always. So I will see you guys later. I hope you have a fantastic week. Little Kylo boy goes for surgery tomorrow, so pray for me. Keep your fingers crossed. Keep us in your thoughts. I'm so nervous. I know that this needs to be done for him, and I'm just so scared. That's my baby. But we shall see how it goes, and I start a new job tomorrow. So, whoa, we got a lot going on in this crazy life of mine. So, can't wait to hear from you guys. I will talk to you later. Bye.